School Night. Written by Silent Walrus. Read by Opal Song. Fandom, Full Metal Alchemist. Rating, explicit. Relationships, Edward Elric, Winry Rockabell. Mei Chang, Alphonse Elric. Edward Elric, original male character. Also tagged for, a bunch of OCs. Men getting pegged. Party politics. Casual sex. Trans male character. More undergrad shit. Post-canon. Ed at adrenaline. Lol, fucked around and got addicted. Police. Ed versus law enforcement. Nobody wins. And police misconduct. Part 5 of Caveat Emptor.
Wake up in the morning feeling like P. Diddy.
Hey, what up,
grab
girl?
My glasses, I'm out the door. I'm gonna hit this city.
Let's
before
go.
I leave, brush my teeth with a bottle of Jack. Cause when I leave for the night, I ain't coming back. I'm talking pedicure on our toes. Trying on all our clothes. Boys blowing up our phones. Dropped up and playing our favorite CDs. Pulling up to the parties. Trying to get a little bit tipsy. Don't stop, make it pop, DJ, blow my speakers up tonight. I'ma fight till we see the sunlight. Tick-tock on the clock, but the party don't stop, no. Don't stop, make it pop, DJ, blow my speakers up tonight. I'ma fight till we see the sunlight. Tick-tock on the clock, but the party don't stop, no.
Chapter 1. Winry comes visiting for a whole week, primarily, she says, because she doesn't believe Ed has friends. I do too have friends, Ed argues. I have lots of friends. People you fucked once in a train station bathroom don't count, Ed. One time. That was one time. And I'll believe it when I see it, she says. To which the only response is to hang up and resolve to take her to one of the never-ending sports parties. Winry arrives sunburned, freckled, and having sprouted 6 new piercings, which is pretty much the expected state of things. Ed shoulders her duffel and waves for a cab where the rail station disgorges into the street, his chin bumping her clavicle when she commandeers his free side for a slightly sticky spring hug. What, no luggy? She's with Paninia, Wynn dismisses. I gotta go to Bassar after this. It wasn't worth it to bring her. Anyway, did you hear about the gondola plan for Rush Valley? They want to set up a line all the way from the rail station to the second ridge over the canyon. Gondola talk turns almost immediately into Rush Valley's prototype super magical, theoretically, hopefully, please God, earthquake-proof electric grid, which is a fun problem, and at least half of why Ed stayed in Rush Valley as long as he did in 1919. Building an earthquake-proof grid is impossible, but you can make an earthquake-resilient one. Power lines can be disrupted and poles can fall down. Isn't much you can do about that besides speed up response time. But the reactors and converters take longer to fix than some downed poles and snapped wires. And those can be built in quake-absorbent frames. A lot of people are experimenting with shake-proof poles, too. The ones in the city, at least. Because generally, if you tell the average Rush Valley local that something's impossible, they'll have 12 prototypes for you by Monday. That takes them all the way to the apartment, up the stairs and into the kitchen, where Winry proceeds to say, "No, I ate on the train. It's past dinner, anyway." While actively rummaging through their fridge. Shut up, I'm just pre-gaming. You've told me how your imaginary sports friends drink. She extracts a cucumber and Al's leftover dumplings and starts crunching as she hips the door shut, cheeks hamstering.
We just waiting for Al, right? And May?
You get to tell him you ate his dumplings, Ed warns over his shoulder, towing Wynn's duffel to his room. He hears a squeak and then some hasty refridging noises. Okay, but what I mean is, how much time do we have? Wynn says, reappearing in his bedroom doorway and wiping at her mouth like that'll wipe away her sins. Depends on how long it'll take you to get ready, Ed says skeptically. Wynn scoffs, striding over to unzip her duffel and start her usual routine of dumping stuff on Ed's desk chair. Like 10 minutes? It's some college party, not the winter ball. And she pops up out of the duffel and spins around with one hand cocked on her hip, waggling a familiar cheery green case. I brought the strap on. Ed groans, even as her goofy, bouncing eyebrows do start up a tingle. You just want me to look at your clit piercing? No, I don't. With the strap on, you can't even see the piercings. How are you such a squeamy baby about this? I don't know. Needles, Ed stresses for the billionth time, catching the case when she tosses it at him. Going under your skin. It's... Why does this have eyes? What? Oh, Paninia said it looked like a frog. She put frog eyes on your dildo case. Yes, Winry says very seriously. And I expect you to rib it when you come. Come on, you said the party's at 9. We got a shower. The shower's not exactly roomy, but it's not like they're doubling up to get some space. Wynn pins Ed face first to the shower wall, after some yelping and struggling, because the tile is cold, damn it. You have to warm it up. And rubs on him until he's pushing back into her, after which she takes her hand away, makes them both wash their hair, full shampoo and conditioning, then has them soap each other down and towel off, and is eyeballing the blow dryer when Ed finally scoops her up, shrieking, and bodily delivers her to the bed, which is what she was going for in the first place. You can just ask, Ed complains, groping around for the damn frog dildo. I'll do it. It's not like I won't. But this way's more fun, Wynn says chirpily, batting her eyelashes and then cackling like a witch when Ed wangs the dildo at her. She catches it easily and points it back at him like a broadsword, striking a naked pose. Do you really want to be so uppity with me right now? Have you met me? You better watch it, mister. Ed makes his eyes big and his voice high and quavery. Or what? You'll frog me? This time, Wynn tackles him to the bed, going right for his jugular and savaging a hickey into it, despite the fact that the dildo is trapped somewhere between them and is trying to give Ed a new belly button. Things continue in this vein for a bit. Ed always forgets how toothy Wynn gets, but it's fun to get the reminder, before she finally lets up to wipe her mouth and finds the strap-on harness. She doesn't much like penetration. What, because if you stick something in, it all starts clacking and jangling like a discount cowbell? I'll put you in a cowbell, you ungrateful, overfucked oaf. But she likes being the one putting it to him just fine, which is a state of affairs that has worked out extremely great for them historically. That means Ed gets to flop on his back. Wynn likes him face up, at least to start, while Winry does the frankly hilarious hop and yank to get the strap-on harness on. It also makes everything jiggle in extremely distracting ways, so by the time Wynn crawls onto the mattress, Ed's pretty much ready to go. Well, hello there, Winry says, giving him a friendly little pat on the pubes. Looks like that estrogen doodad is working. Oh no. 0 out of 10, Ed says flatly. Sex disqualification. Medical equipment is not dirty talk. But I'm just saying how wet your pussy is, Wynn says innocently, uncapping the lube. Those are not the words you used. Terminology matters, And don't you pretend like your favorite part of my vagina ain't how it's got biotech now. You gotta admit it's cool, Wynn says in a reasonable voice, a hilarious contrast with the vigorous jack-off motions she's doing to lube up the bright green dildo. The fact that you can just stick it up there? Yeah, yeah, y'all are building a better fucking Rush Valley. I'm just glad Panina didn't put eyeballs on that thing, too. Wynn cackles, then starts looking thoughtful. So Ed spreads his legs all the way out in a side split to distract her, quick, before she decides to start a new line of creepy automail sex toys and make him the demo test for all of them. Wynn hums approvingly, her face going satisfyingly greedy as her gaze drags down, then back up his body. Arms up. Show me. That brings a little heat to Ed's face as he stretches, arching his back a bit to push out his chest and wrapping his hands around the headboard struts. Wynn grins down at him, rewarding the obedience by shimmying up and showing him how she squeezes her own tits. Knees too, she orders. Aw, come on. Up, I said. Do it. She punctuates by dragging her nails down his inner thigh, digging in just sharp enough. And Ed hisses and does it, heat flaring up as she pulls his knees to his chest. But it has the intended effect, namely, Winry sticking her dick in him. Ed sighs out. Wynn bites her lip. They both nudge around a bit. And then Wynn starts to move. She likes to start slow, dragging, her strokes deep and leisurely because she knows it drives Ed crazy and won't make him come. Resistance is futile, so Ed's usual strategy is to get Wynn just annoyed enough to shut him up without crossing the line into pissed enough to edge him. So he rolls his eyes at her grin and wraps his legs around her waist, trying not to pinch with the automail, but tight enough to stifle her thrusts and shove her dick into him deep. Did I say you can do that? Wynn demands, but Ed moans in overblown delirium and drags his hands through his hair. Oh no, I've been bad. Are you gonna punish me? Wynn brays, laughing so hard she nearly falls over, hands slamming into his chest to keep herself upright. No, you can't. I can't, she wheezes, face going crimson. You, no, that guy in Kessel who asked you, who's your daddy? That sets Ed off instantly. You should have told him, Wynn gasps as Ed claws at the sheets in hysteria. You should have said, known enemy of the state. That's classified. Classified, Ed howls. Who's your daddy? That's classified. Who's your daddy? Wynn growls in terrible approximation of the sexy voice the dude had tried. And Ed nearly eats his own tongue. This is a military investigation. Stop! Stop! Have you seen this man? We don't have time for this. Al's gonna come home. I said, who's your daddy? Ed laughs so hard the dildo jolts out of him, which doesn't exactly calm him down any. And Wynn, wheezing, eventually has to smother him with a pillow. Okay, Ed gasps, clawing his way back to air. Okay, real sex this time. For real. No D word. And Wynn agrees. The only D right now is this dick. Which at least gets them back on track in the mechanicals. And Wynn must have caught a glimpse of the clock or something, because she doesn't start with the slow shit again. Just lines herself up, still giggling, and starts going to town. It's good, as usual. Even if neither of them can really keep a straight face, as usual. She bares her teeth at him. He flutters his lashes at her. She pinches his nipples until he repents and directs his energies towards meeting her thrusts. Wynn might like him face up to start, but through a lot of trial and error, they learned that he just can't come like that. Has to be belly down. So when Ed feels it start to build, he hikes a knee up and Wynn gets the point, pulling back enough to let him turn over. He kneels up for her to push back in, her chin hooking over his shoulder. And from there, with their hands overlapping as they reach for his clit, it goes easy. Ed tips right over, bracing on one hand as he comes, gasping. Wynn stays with him as usual, not letting up with her hips or her hand as she pushes for the second go without waiting for the first to subside. Ed squeezes his eyes shut and rides it, biting his lips to catch the noises in his teeth as Wynn presses in hard, cresting him over again. She stays close, grinding in, draped over his back. Ed feels her breath hitch in his ear and her thighs shake against his and knows she's coming too. She slumps her whole weight on him for a moment, and Ed lets his right hand sway to the mattress to brace them both. It doesn't last, of course. Wynn's hips begin to shift again, dragging the cock out of Ed in a way that makes him twitch. Both her hands settle on his hips. "Nice," she pants, starting to thrust slow but with a clear intention of speeding up. "That's two. Want to break a record today?" "No," Ed groans. Because while one of the things T did was take his orgasm average from laughable to hilarious, they do have somewhere to be, like soon. And Alan May will be here before then. "We gotta, betcha I can get you to three." "No, you can't. You know you can. It's not even a challenge." "Sure it is." Wynn grunts and speeds up. And people say Ed is competitive. Winry's got some kind of insane mental tally where she's on this eternal quest to, like, get him up to par or something. Because she still thinks he just wasn't trying hard enough to have a normal sex life as a teenager. Ed likes to point out that the whole apocalypse thing going on might have had something to do with it. Wynn usually responds by wondering why the imminent demise of their nation would have anything to do with his masturbation technique. They have an argument about the theoretical upper threshold of quality even possible when you're on the run from the feds. And either way, the sex pretty much always ends with Wynn slow roast porking him, like she's trying to make up for all the wanks he didn't have while he was trying to keep them all from dying. Ed realizes that he probably shouldn't be thinking about masturbation stats or the apocalypse while getting dicked, just as Winry also seems to realize he's being too quiet and sinks her nails into his ass cheek. Then there's a sudden bang, which is very clearly the front door whacking open. "Here we can... Oh, Ed's home," comes Al's voice. "Brother, come help carry this... Oh, Winry's here too. Never mind, shower first." Winry cracks up as Ed groans and let his knees slide them flat to the mattress. Wynn riding him down like a gleeful toddler on a deflating balloon slide. "Okay, so much for that orgasm," she snickers. "We'll take a rain check. How about that?" "Ugh, now we gotta shower again." "Don't bitch. It's just a rinse this time. Come on, up, up, before Al wedges the door shut again." It turns out, once they've pushed each other out of the shower and into pants, that what they're helping Al carry is more of May's mail. She's officially here as an alchemist with the Xingyi's delegation and is technically staying at the new embassy. But mainly what that means is she's using the diplomatic mail access to ship a billion kilos of interior decor across the border. Ed's not sure what the fuck she even puts on the forms, because she's not decorating the interior so much as terraforming the whole apartment. Admittedly, some of that was Ed. The original floor plan sucked. He fixed it. But now stepping into 2B2427 Hickory Street is like being teleported into a particularly intense Western Xingyi's tea house. Ed knows for a fact that May's not just disassembling and reconstructing her childhood home in their apartment, because he's been to the Chang clan compound, and May grew up sleeping in a communal brick Kong bed where the heating stove doubled as the family kitchen. The only alternative that leaves, however, is that she's piecemeal importing Al some kind of miniaturized palace, which, objectively considered, is insane, and not something Ed at all objects to. Okay, he was like, what the hell? In the beginning. But that was mostly because May and Winry kept saying the place was barren and looked like a creepy squatter's camp. And anyway, ever since May put up the snarling lion statuettes, Ed has been 100% on board. At this point, they've got damn near everything but a moonfish pond, though. So Ed can't fucking imagine what the fuck is in these crates. Actually, a moonfish pond would be cool. Maybe he'll put one in himself. Mrs. Chagat, who owns the nail salon downstairs, doesn't care what they do since they fix up the building, and Ed walks Chowder all the time. She'd probably be cool with him messing with the backyard. The crates, it turns out, are full of rugs. Half full, at least. Ed realizes this was all packed and mailed up by the Chang personally when the rugs are unwrapped and unfolded to reveal endless packages of newspaper-wrapped yolk cakes and dried fruit and cough drops and stomach medicine and pickled vegetables triple cushioned in spare socks. For a clan that let her cross the desert alone as a child, May's entire family sure seems pretty convinced she's going to simultaneously starve to death and die of every disease possible in the howling wasteland that is the capital city of Amstress. Population only 5 million. You want them to have sent me mail when I don't even have an address? May demands when Ed mutters something or other to that effect. When I was wandering your country hunted by demons and murderers? She sniffs. Besides, they could not have afforded it then. That's true. May's a whole little princess now. Always done up fancy as all hell, even when she wears Amstrian stuff. First thing the Yao clan did upon taking the throne is start throwing out alliance offers right and left. And they started with the smaller, weaker clans like the Chang. That way, when it came to approaching the bigger, wealthier, competing clans, the Yao could point at their nice, shiny new coalition and say, all friendly and diplomatic-like, hey, everybody else is doing it. Wouldn't want to be left out in the cold alone now, would you? So that worked, more or less. And May's mom immediately did the smart thing and packed May off to a bunch of alchemistic temples and famous teachers all over the ass ends of Shang. Because while Chang might be tight with the Yao now, that doesn't mean they can dictate terms yet when it comes to marriages and business deals. The Chang know Mei is a critical fucking asset now, and continuing her education and leveling up into an even more badass alchemist are the reasons that potential suitors will accept as reasons for why May isn't currently on offer. It'll just make her a sweeter get down the line, after all. It sounds like a whole lot of hell to Ed, personally, but May doesn't seem to mind. Even if she does agree, they're all just lucky her mom wanted her little girl to see the world and get experienced and build outside connections before turning up formally at the fucking knife party of the Imperial Court. Ed's well aware that he and Al are some of those outside connections. And that's why they were allowed to travel with May to the Alchemy temples and incidentally hit every sightseeing spot along the way. Al is a lot more than potential suitor now. And since May's all over him, he's been given a probationary sort of dibs. It's not like they're living in sin or whatever. May's grandma had just made a lot of terrifying comments about fresh horses and testing new bridles that Ed understood just enough of to blush anytime she cackled. But nobody's made any promises and nothing is set in stone. Not that Ed's worried. May swoons every time Al so much as flushes the toilet, and Al's quietly but obviously just fine with May's semi-dictatorial takeover of his life. They wear little matching outfits, for fuck's sake. Al even helps her with her hair now, sitting in the living room together with him on the couch and her on the floor, getting ready for the party, and it's, well, really cute, sweet and all, hard to look at. It's not that they get mushy or gross or anything. It's just that Al's face is always serious, open, a little odd. He's falling in love. Ed's so happy it's bruising his ribs from the inside. He can't separate the ache from the light. Wouldn't if he could, maybe. Nothing is permanent. All things change. And so he makes sure he doesn't avoid it. Doesn't try to look away from Al's happiness, from the future he's building, that's going to take him far away. Or, at least, not until they turn the hair messing on him, because it turned out, in his efforts not to avoid it, he ended up looking like he wanted to join in or something. He had to tell people he lost a bet or something, because my 3 calcium supplements a day little brother and his 5-foot-tall girlfriend held me down and gave me pin curls is not a scenario he wants to advertise. Anyway, these days it's much safer to beat feet back to where Winry's hogging the bathroom. Ed is not fucking showing up to this party in a crown braid. Win's fucking topless again, which briefly reminds Ed about that KIA third orgasm. But given she's armed with a mascara wand, it doesn't last long. Just dissipates back out into a vague throb. Honestly, he's just glad he can have sex with her again. It's a thought that crops up often. Oftener still when she's in his space, leaning on the bathroom counter, 3 inches away from the mirror and squinting her eyeliner on, while he drags the heavy-duty brush through his hair. Getting over himself took a while, and at first it really fucking sucked. But then he went and found out he could fuck people without any feelings involved whatsoever, or at least not any more than a vague appreciation of form and cursory approval of character. It kind of balanced things out, going so far in the opposite direction. Or maybe it was just that they weren't living in each other's ass cracks anymore. Ed hadn't known he'd needed to move around so much. When growing up, moving around was all he had. He still doesn't quite know why he got stuck with Wynn. It feels something like he should be able to want. He likes Panina fine, and Marley, and that guy with the dreads who runs the big machining shop closest to Winry's workshop. They all like him fine, too. And he wants Winry to be the furthest thing from alone. But sharing her attention with weekend trips to clients and 11-hour surgeries and days in the machine shop is fine. It's just sharing with another lover that doesn't work. He can't figure out why it doesn't. He doesn't want to be the guy who lays down ultimatums, who forces Winry to choose, who keeps her from loving everybody she wants to love. He doesn't want to be the selfish, jealous asshole thinking, but what about me? But, well, thank fuck he went to Jing when he did, because they do this stuff way differently over there, and he learned a lot. He found out that courtesan is a political office, for one, and that you can have as many spouses as you can handle, to the point where, like, 5 of their most famous comedies and drama plays are about people who had 7 twin wives or disguised themselves as their 4th husband or whatever. Ling's dad was the emperor, but Ling's mom's husbands are 3 totally different guys altogether. And Ed was there when Ai Chung congratulated her daughter on her choice of boyfriend, but gently reminded her that she was an imperial princess and a skilled alchemist, and shouldn't limit herself to just one. May had to smack Ed a bit to keep him from squawking on that one. But it led to a lot of really useful talking, and it turned out Al was at least in the know already about how he might end up having not so much competition as assigned group work. "You didn't tell me that," Ed exclaimed. "You didn't say that you can marry just as many people as you can date."
"Amstrians are strange about these things," May sniffed. "Your inheritances are a mess, full of court cases and lawyers and public arguments."
"Ours is a mess? Yours is based on whether or not someone's royally related enough or not."
That one devolved into a bit of a slap fight about what constitutes a court anyway. But the point is, the Jingyis have done this for so long that there's manuals about it. They have all this stuff on how to handle it when you can't handle it.
"You are hardly the only one who doesn't share well," Ling's mom told him lightly. Lanfan lurking in the background as one of their escorts that day.
"The Meng clan are famous for it. The Sung make it a point in their wedding contract stipulations."
"Look, I just said I can't be the emperor's, concubine," Ed had said uncomfortably.
Bajiki Yao had just given him a tolerant smile and carried on talking about how totally fine and okay barbarian monogamy was, as if he'd said nothing. And then she gave him prosperous fields, which was 85% about how to farm rice on a mountain and 15% about how to manage your family when you've got only one spouse or no kids or wives and husbands and kids out the wazoo and you're the one holding the clan title. A lot of it was outdated, preachy, and self-evident. "Do not give one spouse more rice than the other, lest ye breed resentment," and that sort of thing. But he figured what she wanted him to pay attention to was the bit where it talked about dealing honestly with your people and how to work with nature, not against it. There's probably a prettier way to say it. The main text of the book itself was in the vernacular, but all the chapters began with a couple lines of poetry, and Ed got that it was a kind of topic-theme moral card. But he can't understand full classical Jingyis, and he'd given up after mistranslating persistence at a useless task as goat hole, despite an hour with two dictionaries. He'd finally given in and asked one of the bodyguards assigned to him for help. Deng Jun was pretty nice about it, or at least maintained a really good deadpan. And then, when Ed went to return the book, Ling's mom gave him The Golden Household, which was 5% politics and 95% pornography. Prosperous Fields was clearly written by some stodgy old farmer, but this was a novel and probably first written in a greasy notebook kept under a mattress in some really shaky handwriting. Apart from the billion sex acts described in painstaking detail, it was a story of Golden Dawn, the third wife of some famous rich guy referred to only by epithets. It took Ed way too long to realize this guy was an emperor, and an actual historical one to boot, like the second guy to ever make it on the throne or something, and how she basically took over his entire court through the powers of pussy. The point there, as far as Ed could tell, was that Golden Dawn succeeded in becoming empress not by ousting her rivals, but by bringing them over to her side, and then straight murdering the handful of remaining ones who wouldn't get with the plan. So, okay, maybe more the power of unionization than pussy, but since her pussy was mostly what she was unionizing with, Ed feels it counts. And the message in this one also probably wasn't, "Become one of my son's concubines and stage an aggressive, if not necessarily, hostile coup. Also, here's a step-by-step instruction manual of how to do that seriously upsetting thing on page 273. So, it has to have been all of the stuff about how jealousy was just a knife that stabbed your own back, and to, once again, go with your nature instead of against it. Either find a way to handle it, some deal that works for you and yours, or get the fuck out. Oh, and maybe don't make any risky moves against your enemies until you've got overwhelming numbers on your sides. Around here, we deal for keeps. Ed likes to think he got the point. He's still got no idea how he feels about Ling's mom giving him porn. That's a lie. He knows exactly how he feels, and it's the Dowager Empress of Jing thinks I'm a barely literate barbarian slut. But he can't deny it was, you know, helpful. In that he's definitely okay with not sleeping with Ling anymore due to getting some up-close, personal, and even historical examples of what that entails long-term. Them fucking was fun, sure, but it wasn't critical. It wasn't load-bearing. It wasn't the point. And it's not the point with Winry, either. She likes to have sex, and so does he, and they like it with each other. But it didn't exactly break her heart when they went from whatever it was to whatever it is. And all the in-between parts where he fucked off to Jing. The point is, Winry does love him. And he's glad he can give this to her without shoving glass under his own fingernails for it. They decide to walk to the trolley instead of squeezing into a cab, because it's a nice night out, and the line that takes a straight shot to the main university gates is right on the other side of the greenbelt. A gaggle of Al's assorted medical ducklings turn up when they turn the corner, dressed in various flavors of nerd, which, upon commingling, makes starched-up Al and May in her little perfect green qipao look like a couple of peacocks accidentally walked in on a chicken coop. "These your imaginary friends?" Wynn whispers in Ed's ear as the chickens make undergrad noises at Al. "No! They're not your friends. They're not imaginary, and that's Al's club people. Can't you tell by all the cat hair? What I can tell is that Al has more friends than you," Wynn says. So Ed elbows her. "You just keep promising me they exist somewhere," she continues dolefully, shoving back. "But I've been burned too many times." And their resulting slap fight carries them just ahead enough of Al's group that they don't really have to interact. It's not that Ed doesn't like Al's friends. It's just that their schedules are largely incompatible, and also they kind of think he's a violent hooligan. Which, okay, he doesn't give a shit about. Only, one day on his way home, he saw What's-Her-Face with the double braids toss a coin into the weird little memorial on the corner of 6th and Plaza, set up by the "Full Metal is definitely dead and the government is covering it up. Poor lad died so young" people. He'd wondered why the hell it was there, of all places, before he realized that was the corner where he'd started throwing around alchemy and fixed shit to lure out Scar so long ago. He can't fucking believe it made that much of a dent. Braid's chick has no fucking clue who he and Al are, obviously. And it's not like she talks about how great and sad the Full Metal Alchemist was or whatever. But it's still something Ed can't help but hold in his mind every time he sees her and the rest. Candies and flowers and coins tossed into an urn with his name on it, cleaned out by homeless guys every night. Being dead and famous is weird as hell. It's not so weird for Al, obviously. And while he likes his cat club well enough, he hasn't expressed any desire for them or Ed to be more than passingly aware of each other. Which means Ed doesn't have to figure out how to get tight with any of them. And Ed does have friends. It turns out that by joining the gymnastics team, they're assigned to you more or less automatically. The coaches still don't really know what to do with Ed, but McKenna, team captain, represents them at student budget meetings, picks the aggressively upbeat music they drill to, and is responsible for morale. Only wanted to know two things. Can he do a handspring? More importantly, can he pay the team dues and equipment fee? Yeah, Ed had said, because he'd only come down to the gym to waggle his metal leg at them and find out if he could join at all. And one of the coaches had opened his mouth, but McKenna had whirled and said, "The dues pay into the competition travel fund, but he's not going to compete." And the coach shut his mouth, apparently having done the math. "Of course you can join," McKenna continued to Ed, in the bright, sweet tones you use on someone you're about to swindle into a new tax bracket. "Come on, let's see what you can do." Not even a third of what the rest of the team could, it turned out. But the coaches agreed he had potential, and not just because his acceptance basically meant free money. "And the more members we have, the more we automatically get from the University Student Sports Fund," McKenna had said, darkly satisfied. "Welcome to the team." So Ed's with the gymnasts now. He likes them, to his own surprise. They're a lot less damp than everybody else so far. A lot of them have been doing stuff by themselves since they were young, traveling alone to meetups and sports camps and competitions, and none are strangers to injury or hard training. Shalane ripped his whole hand open on the bars last week, and it was gross as all hell, and nobody blinked. 3 weeks before that, Kel had gotten what McKenna called intense, and what Ed recognized as the clenching, dry-eyed shakes that came after trying and trying and trying until you felt crazier than nuts, and the goal was still just out of reach. A lot of the university kids just don't have that. They're not, like, worse. They're all normal people or whatever. But the way they live their lives is kind of unrecognizable. The first time Ed heard someone say, "I have to ask my mom first." Well, it's not like he forgot moms, obviously, or the existence or function of parents in general. But it was this weird, baffling window into how normal families work. Ed's closest model for normal is Winry, and if not for Granny, she'd be in the exact same boat as him, minus all the fucked up alchemy shit. Hell, even Teacher and Sig, that's the closest place to home now that he and Al have got, probably, besides the Rockabell house. And even there, it's, well, complicated. Sometimes Ed wonders what the fuck he's doing, finishing out university. He signed up because Al made it sound interesting, and everybody agreed it was a good idea for him to... Okay, sure, win. Make friends. But in practice, all the social stuff has been a constant oscillation of hilarity, bewilderment, anthropological fascination, and homicidal boredom. He doesn't, like, need people to be talking about the meaning of life and death and the innermost laws of the universe at every minute of every day or anything. But half the time he feels like he's in one of those dreams where he gets abducted by aliens, and they're all standing around discussing what bits to cut off him, and he somehow simultaneously knows what they're saying and can't understand a word. Which is why the gymnasts are such a fucking relief in some ways. Landy and Brinley and the rest aren't going to be winning any mentalist awards, but they don't fucking have to. They're easy to be with, and they're good people, and they have more in common in their childhoods than Ed ever expected. Stuff like travel and practice and pressure that he hasn't really encountered much elsewhere in Central U. It's not like Ed was unique in starting work young, but generally those who take apprenticeships don't go to university. If you've already got a working business at 17, going in for a degree at 20 is usually more a matter of personal preference than necessity. Winry's toying with doing a formal surgery residency with one of the more specialized medical teams in Central or East, but she loves the machining aspect of making automail too much to depart fully from limbs into the finicky, tiny tube fields of gastro or cardio or even neurosurgery. Rush Valley is hard at work at making implantable artificial organs, but those have to be a lot more squishy and flexible and made of plastics than limbs do, And Wynn's a damn gearhead at heart. Besides, she's having way too much fun making hardcore sports models for limb prostheses. Paninia has a set of legs that lets her jump over cars these days. And Ed's got three fucking legs on her workshop wall. Pretty much showpieces only at this point. His current leg isn't anything fancy, but it does have titanium plating for the shin guard and kneecap, and enough shock absorbers to let him do a triple layout on a trampoline run. Because while Ed doesn't get into nearly as much fighting as he used to, Wynn knows he's still not exactly living the delicate dandy life out here. He's not sure he even can. Sparring is fun. Exercise that lights up his body and his brain in that specific way. Gasoline, high wire, and it's one thing he's not getting from gymnastics. Which he should really do something about, he resolves, as his and Winry's shoving ends with him lifting her half over his shoulder as she shrieks, grabbing at his shoulders as he threatens to flip her into the park hedge. There are martial arts gyms that'll take people with automail, but those tend to be the bring-your-own-barstool-everything-goes places full of assholes with actual combat mods and something to prove. And Ed can't be sure that if he actually has to fight for real, he won't instinctively resort to alchemy. The itch isn't so bad yet that he needs to scratch it, but the fact that it's there in the first place is a warning sign. Of what? He's not exactly sure. It's not like he thinks he's gonna snap and start hitting people with the nearest chair. But people can tell there's something off. And that tells Ed he needs to at least get a handle on what the fuck it is. Even when he's keeping his mouth shut, copying Al and listening instead of talking. Guys will get touchy, girls will get uncomfortable, professors and admins and co-workers get snippy or taken aback. It took him a while to realize that at least part of it is, while he's not doing anything different than he used to, he just doesn't look like a kid anymore. These days, when he stares someone down, they're a lot more likely to square up or back away than laugh or get bewildered. And he's reminded that he's not elbow high and thin as a reed anymore. He's learned to make a little less direct eye contact and put up a lot more sweetie smiling, just so people would calm the fuck down around him. This is where the gymnast score is high again, because McKenna and the rest showed him how you can do that and still be a weapons-grade asshole. Seriously, even Mustang could take notes. It's also possible that nothing will ever top the way his face froze when Ed pulled that shit with the soft floor guy, which frankly makes all the rest worth it just by itself. He looked like he thought Ed was about to peel his face open and turn into a swarm of locusts. It's not often Mustang looks any kind of off guard, let alone frantically trying to signal, "Abort! Abort!" with nothing but his eyebrow hairs. So Ed's gonna be cherishing that one for a good long time. It'd been a good fucking day. So yeah, Ed likes gymnasts. Almost all of them are shorter than him, too. And, Ed learned, if you're part of the team, you automatically get invited to everything. Someone is always having some kind of party, and the sports teams tend to be involved in some way or another. You can pretty much bring whoever, too, which is why they're all out here right now, walking along the canal toward the trolley stop. Ed and Wynn quit horsing around when they leave the park, because it is a nice night, and there's a bunch of people around who'd probably be a lot less chill with them when it looks like they're about to flip each other into traffic instead of the nearest bush. Even after living in Central for a couple of years now, Ed's still amazed by how it comes alive at night. There's tea lamps and fairy lights strung across whole streets, wrapped around trees, tied into constellation shapes of stars and swirls and flowers. And out of the day's heat, the restaurants and bars throw all their windows and doors open, cigarette and shisha smoke trailing out,
different strains of music, somehow more intermingling than competing. They aren't the only group headed for the trolley. Central U may be the biggest, but it's not the only university in town, and it's Friday night right after midterms. There's even a pack of bikers lounging around their motorcycles at the canal railing, parked across the pedestrian strip and the water access path with a radio playing. Ed eyes them idly as they walk past, with Wynn doing the same next to him, though she's probably focusing more on the bikes than the tattoos and leather. Then Wynn stops dead and seizes Ed's arm with all five nails sinking in. Is that a victory six? Ed says, what? But Wynn's already zipped across the street, hair flashing in the streetlights as she goes right for the bike. Ed groans and follows her, only glancing around when he realizes the rest of the group is hanging back. Al looking amused, May looking impatient, and the rest of them looking like they're not sure whether to stage an intervention. Well, whatever. Just let her check it out. It's not going to take that long, Ed tells them, turning back to follow Winry. Y'all can go ahead if you like. He hears Al say, it's fine, still sounding amused. And it's not in the extremely specific exasperated voice he uses when he says, it's fine, to Ed, so he's not talking to him. Winry's already practically nose to headlights with the bike. Yeah, okay. Ed might not know shit about cars and stuff, but even he can see it's a nice-looking ride. The bike guys all look pretty surprised. But then again, Wynn's a special kind of nerd. The guy with the bike is a big, curly-haired dude, looking pretty taken aback to find Winry's ponytail nearly going up his nostrils as she leans excitedly over the fuel tank. But he recovers quick. Whoa there, honey, he says, half-laughing. Yeah, it's a six. You like bikes?
I love bikes, Wynn breathes, staring directly at the big shiny muffler.
Then she remembers herself, flicks her gaze up at the guy and tucks some hair behind her ear, letting the corner of her smile curl up. It makes her face go simultaneously somehow wicked and sweet, in a way that always leaves Ed equal parts dreading, turned on, and impressed. Can I sit on it? A round of hoos goes up, the guys laughing and ribbing each other. Sure, honey, Curly laughs, not stepping back as he beckons, holding the handlebars. Why not? Of course, when Wynn swings her leg wide to saddle up, he has to step back quick anyway.
Wow,
Wynn breathes as she grips the handlebars, eyes shining. How's she handle? What's the acceleration? I heard with the right mods you can hit 100 in 3 seconds. But that kind of injector fuel requires modifications to the actual frame. Do you race? Oh my gosh, I've been dying to try one of these. Nothing made before 1920 has Schmidt-Valsi suspension. There's a lot more of that, but Curly's just back to looking surprised, not hostile, which leaves Ed free to check out the rest of the guys. Bikes are cool and all, but machinery in general's pretty boring. What Ed likes about good rides is the indicators they provide about the driver. For example, the smaller the muffler, the smaller the dick. This lot looks much shinier and much more put together than Big Mally and her guys back in Rush Valley. But that's probably just because Central's all paved roads and green belts instead of a canyon full of yellow dust and scratching gravel. They also look younger than Big Mally's bunch. But that's not hard. Big Mally knew Granny Pinaco when she worked in Rush Valley. And three others actually went to school with her, with books and uniforms and everything. Which is bizarre and so weird and very cool. There were photos. Ed had no idea Granny has tattoos, and kind of wishes he could forget. This lot looks a lot more like people Ed would see hanging out around the spike bars in Dublin, back when he and Al were studying with teacher. More decorative than utilitarian. No women, though. Ed had no idea Central even had bike people,
Because it's not like you need one to get around or deliver mail or groceries or and stuff. And he hasn't really seen any before. But this is a lot of bikes, and maybe there's other groups somewhere with their own garage. He doesn't go out to the West Side rail yards much. Maybe they all hang out there. These bikes all look pretty new and expensive, though. No cargo rigs, only a couple of passenger seats. All sports bikes. Ed realizes, belatedly, that Al's pals aren't hanging back like that because they're impatient to get to the party. It's because this is a group of big dudes in gear that probably looks like it means business to someone who hasn't actually worn leather day in and day out and found out the hard way that decorative shit won't cut it for workwear. This here is a good-looking enough bunch that Ed has to wonder if, maybe, there's some kind of promotional team or something. New paint, polished chrome, thick arms, big boots, fun jackets. A couple of them glance back at his once-overs, but Wynn's talking a mile a minute while wearing a party shirt that's one zipper away from being two pocket squares and a shoelace, and all desperately holding hands. He's not expecting to sustain attention here. There's a big guy lounging in the back who's steadily watching Ed instead of Wynn, though. Long black hair and a tail, broad face. Jingyi's or Khmer or something. And he returns Ed's up and down with an easy look of self-assured superiority. From over here, Ed can't tell if it's just smug asshole or smug asshole wants to fuck. So he just returns the most bovine blink possible and turns back to Winry. And I only ever saw it in magazines. Oh, I just wish I could try. Do you think I could? Just for a minute? Wynn's now moved on to the big pleading eyes, her whole face shining with the innocent longing of a wolf puppy staring at a flock of lambs. Just up and down the block. Oh, I can't believe I'm actually touching one. Please, just once? Well, I don't know, Curly starts, half playful. Maybe I should get on with you. But the ponytail guy at the back waves a gloved hand. All the bikers' heads turn to him in a wave. Let her try. Curly looks like he's about to say something, but he clearly thinks better of it after a second glance at ponytail guy. And in any case, Wynn's already letting out a whoop and starting the engine. Curly starts looking a lot more alarmed then, and he's not the only one. But it's too late. Wind's peeling out, the engine snarling like a happy tiger, as a bunch of the guys start whooping and jeering, too. You can't, she just, hey! Curly exclaims, looking like he's building up to a real shout. So Ed steps over and knocks a boot against his. Yo, she's not gonna go far, Ed says, just as Winry hits the end of the access path and drags the bike into a sharp turn that lifts the rear wheel off the pavement. We got someplace else to be tonight. Curly whips his head around to stare wild-eyed at Ed, then jerks back to Winry. But seeing her slalom back towards them at least keeps him from going full grizzly bear over one little joyride. The guys are ranging out along the edge of the path now, laughing and hollering to watch Wynn go. The med kids are still across the street with Al and don't look a whole lot less Puritan. But Al now looks tolerantly amused, and May just looks bored. Who the fuck is this girl? Curly demands of the universe in general, staring after Winry, hands half up like he maybe wants to pull some hair out. Who does that? Ed helpfully gestures, out of town. Rush Valley. Oh. A couple of the guys glance at Ed to nod knowingly, which means they've probably been, because even the rumors don't do it justice. Rush Valley people are crazy. It's all people who've lost body parts and the mechanics and surgeons who experiment on them, and they all live in hilly, rugged country with deep canyons and sharp cliffs. That means a bunch of ex-soldiers and adrenaline junkies are lumped in with a lot of people who are unbothered by blood and nerve damage. And they all like to sit down with gears and tensor cables and engines and go, what happens if I do this? And then they do it. And getting around, due to the scattered farms and damn cliffs, is done either by donkey or heavy-duty dirt bike. Ed's seen Winry do a backflip on one of those, and it's not like she's going to do anything crazier than that now, not with someone else's bike. "Do you race any?" he asks instead, turning back to look directly at Ponytail. The dude's definitely in charge. He's also still watching Ed. "Oh, once in a while," he says over the growl of the returning bike, eyes flicking down and then up again, lingering. "You Rush Valley too?" "Sure," Ed says, because these days Rezimbul is the place where mutton, wool, and the Full Metal Alchemist comes from, so unless somebody recognizes the specific accent, he doesn't bother bringing it up. "I don't really ride. That's all her. If you're doing something this week, though, let her know. She'll win you money." Just as Wynn squeals the bike back to a stop in front of them. There's a lot of whistling and clapping, and as usual, Wynn eats it up as her due. "That was the best," she gushes, grinning around at everyone, killing the engine and flicking at the kickstop in one fluid move. She's flushed all across her cheeks, visible even in the dark, and pretty much every pair of eyes is glued to her tits as she bounces off the bike. "Gosh, thank you. That was so much fun. What's your name again?" Curly says, now looking a little dazed. "Sam?" "Sam! That was great, Sam. You're great. I love your bike." Wynn pops up on her toes, kisses his cheek just shy of his mouth, then twirls around while he's still reeling and straightens her skirt as she beams at Ed. "Okay, now we can go."
"Leaving so soon?"
Ponytail says, his smile friendly, mostly for Wynn, but tilting it Ed's way some.
"We got other bikes to try."
Of course, sometimes being off-putting comes in useful. Ed smiles back, nothing cute about it.
"Told you, we got somewhere else to be."
But Ponytail cocks his head, smile not fading.
"Where are you headed?"
He doesn't look put off at all.
"Maybe we can give you a ride."
He doesn't say it in a pushy asshole way either, just clear and direct, putting his interest on offer, front and center. His black eyes crinkle at the corners. Calm. His smile steady with just enough of an edge to be interesting. Ed's not about to ditch Wynn and Al to do the hoochie high 5 minutes under some bridge with some biker, good looking or not. But maybe he'll take this way through the park more often. He's about to give the guy the friendly fuck off when Wynn flicks him a glance, then tucks her hair back and bites her lip a little, smiling at Ponytail.
"Well, we were on our way to a party."
Behind her, the med kids exchange horrified looks.
"You guys want to come?"
Boy, do they.